This week's podcast with Di Caudron and Debbie O'Brien of Appleton's Wool is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org. Each month, EGA offers an expansive roster of creative and educational opportunities for needleworkers around the globe. Starting April 28, EGA members can register for a fascinating new virtual lecture, Boyaji, Stitching and Wrapping Happiness with Youngmin Lee. Interested listeners can read an interview with Youngmin Lee on the EGA website to learn more about this uniquely beautiful form of Korean textile art. Then use the code FIBERTALK5, that's FIBERTALK and the number 5, to get a $5 discount on this or any of EGA's virtual lectures, including previous recordings. Learn more at egausa.org. Thanks to EGA for sponsoring the show, and now our conversation with Di and Debbie of Appleton's Wool. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. We have two artists this week from Appleton's Wool, Di Caudron, who is the owner. Di, welcome.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here.
Oh, this is going to be fun. And then the person who's in charge of wool management and 5,000 other things at Appleton's Wool, Debbie O'Brien. Debbie, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
So much here. There's so much history with Appleton's Wool. Just doing the research, I knew it was old because I've been stitching a long time, and when I started, it was ballpoint canvas and Appleton's Wool, and whether you like it or not. And but then when I looked, 1835 was when it started. And Di, you and Julia bought the company in 2013.
That's right. Yeah.
Wow. 178 year old company you buy.
Yes,
we actually. What's that?
Well, we bought it from the last Appleton, who decided to give up. And so we are the first non-Appleton owners since 1835.
Wow.
So I think the company has gone through quite a lot of changes over those years. But it's a very interesting history.
How impressive that it stayed in the family that long.
Yeah.
Wow. Because, most companies these days, the kids don't. They don't want any of it, yeah.
I guess they had big families in those days, too.
Yeah. So what was that like, buying a company with that kind of history? I mean, not just manufacturing history, but needlework history. I mean, Appleton's Wool has just been a staple for so long in needlework. What's that like to buy a company like that in today's market? And there must be real mixture of dealing with tradition and history and then modernization.
Absolutely. It was very tough at the beginning because the company was not in good shape by the time we got to it in 2013. And so we really had to bring it into the 21st century, which has been the challenge from the start. And of course, as you so rightly say, wool now there are so many competitors, whereas at the beginning, we were probably the world leader, and that there was no other company that produced that number of colors.
Right. Unquestioned. Unquestioned. No doubt.
Yeah. And we've still kept up the fact that we have 425 colors in our range in two weights of wool, and this is how we took the company over in 2013. And we've kept that going. We've introduced some more new brighter shades to, as you say, to go into the new markets ahead of us, which has proved very successful. But no, it's very nice to have something with that heritage, because Appleton's is very closely linked with William Morris in the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, mm-hmm. when tapestry was phenomenal. And there are examples of that all over the UK that you can visit and see wonderful, wonderful tapestries. And Appleton's was providing all the wool in those days. But, of course, times change.
Right.
And we're moving ahead now. So we're looking ahead rather than back, I think.
Right. Now, when you purchase the company, colors, but you have, I'm sure, people who worked there forever and machinery that needed to be upgraded.
We inherited some machines that were 120 years old.
Holy smokes.
We didn't take any of the personnel because we moved the company out of London. So we're now in Oxfordshire. We're very close to Oxford. And so none of the employees came with us. And we started absolutely from scratch. And we survived with those very old machines for about 2 years, and now we've replaced everything. So we now have a very modern scanning machine, we have a coning machine, and we bought computers, would you believe? They had nothing but a typewriter.
Oh no.
Yeah, and no website, no, you know, we've started from scratch, really.
Wow.
So,
but I think all the employees, they basically were retirement age, weren't they? They were all,
and they were all very happy to
retire.
Yeah, well, they've had enough. They weren't quite as old as the company, but getting that way. So, yeah.
Gave them a nice exit then.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think so.
No, it's given us new life. Yeah. So that's how it all happened.
Wow. So then that tells me there's some kind of a lull in manufacturing as you get all of this back in place then.
Well, yeah, the first 2 years were tough, I have to admit.
So I think that the most difficult thing, I think, was the fact that as the old owner was kind of, I don't want to say losing interest, but, you know, when we took the company over, we were out of stock of a lot of colours. And that was the biggest challenge, actually, was trying to make sure that we got back into stock of all the colours in both weights, because that's what we never want to be out of stock of anything, because and that can be really difficult when you've got effectively, well, 425 colours in two weights. Right. You know, that's 850 dye lots that you've got to keep on top of with minimum order quantities. And so that was the biggest challenge, was getting back into stock of everything. And then with the machinery, it was the machines that the old machines that we inherited were the scanning machines, and they really looked sort of like something out of Rumpelstiltskin, didn't
well,
they?
Well, out of Dickens, actually.
Dickens.
Yes.
They were these really old, very manual machines, and that's going back to those white labels, because the labels were then all sort of individually gummed and put onto to each of the skeins. And it was incredibly time-consuming and incredibly labour-intensive. And so... But it took a little while for us to... But actually, in saying that, they worked, so the machines worked, and it wasn't as if that there was a problem with the manufacturing there. It was just that it was labor intensive, and right. We knew that if we wanted to grow and increase, we needed to come up with a more sort of automated way of creating the skeins. So that's when we then sort of effectively went to market and found an automatic skeining machine, and yeah, and then that took a little while to bed in, but now it's all fully running and much more automatic, and one guy can run it. So yeah, it's good, and hence the different labels, because it was you couldn't have the individual white gummed labels; it needed to be something different. So
yeah, I ran over yesterday to Sign of the Arrow because they carry the full line of your wool, and I just grabbed a bunch. I'm sure they thought I was nuts because I didn't have a project. I just wanted some skeins of wool because I hadn't handled wool in years, Appleton's wool in years. And so I bought 10 skeins, and two of them have these very generic white labels on them.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Then the others are these red and silver, beautiful, glossy Appleton's wool.
Yeah.
So the old ones, the white ones are the older.
Exactly. They were made on your Dickensian machines. Yeah. Yes. So yeah.
They were.
No, I had a plant tour for my paying job, which is editing a magazine, a manufacturing magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into a plant, and it was very much a mixture of legacy and new machinery.
Yeah.
And on one end are these massive metal presses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, giant, like multi-story metal presses that are just ancient. And the guy said that, you know, these things still work. So when you said that, yeah, they still work. They still get the job done, and they use them all the time. But he said, any parts that break, we have to have a machine shop make them for us.
Make them. Well, that we were in exactly the same position. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
And we started off, I think, when we brought over, didn't we, like six or seven of these machines. There was a number of the machines.
Yes, and we
kept sort of taking bits off of one to replace the other.
So we always tried to have two that were working.
But we did end up with having a lot of bits. In fact, we were thinking of putting them to a museum, weren't we?
They went to a museum.
There we go.
A wall museum. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, when you're down to robbing machines, you need to do something.
Yeah, exactly. It was desperate. It was getting desperate.
Oh, my. So now today we have a fully computerized, automated as much as possible operation. Yeah.
It still needs a machinist on it all the time. Mm-hmm. But it's computerized to a certain extent.
Yeah. To a certain extent, because it's, I mean, what we do here is only really the end part of the picture. I mean, we are, you know, we keep a lot of British textile manufacturing companies busy, because all of our wool is British. So that comes from the British Wool Board. And that's all keeping the farmers, hopefully, busy. And then it goes from there. We then obviously has to go through all the various different processes. It's then all spun up in Yorkshire. And actually, when I went to see the machines there, that's a little bit like these enormous mills. And, you know, if you went back sort of 100 years, there were so many of these mills up in Yorkshire. And now they're there, but a lot of them have sadly been turned into flats and things. But
let's back up. Take us through that whole process. So all of the wool comes from British sheep farmers.
Yeah. So the British sheep farmers form, I guess, is a collective, I suppose, which is the British Wool Board. And so our wool all comes from the British Wool Board, and it's certified so that, you know, they can, it's all traceable back to the auction, I suppose, because the British Wool Board hold auctions. I think it's about 14 times a year or something, and at those auctions you can trace our wool back to the different lots. So that's how the wool has to be bought from the British Wool Board.
Pardon me, intensely curious on all fronts here. Mm-hmm. So when you say an auction, so somebody from Appleton's goes to these auctions
we have a wool. So it's the price is set. The price gets set. So it's auctioned, at which point then I think somehow they must set the price for that auction. And then we actually have a wool commodity buyer, I suppose, who we've dealt with now. In fact, I spoke to him in advance of this just to say, Christopher, how long has Appleton's been using you for, using your family or your company for? And he could go back, 80 to 85 years.
Holy smokes.
I know. We've been using this, not Christopher, but his father before him and his grandfather. He talks about his father and his grandfather quite a lot. And so they've been our sort of wool merchants, I suppose. They've been our wool merchants, and they're up in Yorkshire. So they do. We speak to him about what we need, and they know what we need now because they've been dealing with us for forever.
Well, that was something I was going to interject here.
Yeah,
history aside, real value in that he knows exactly what you need.
Exactly. Yeah, which is really specific, because when you're looking for tapestry wool, it's really important that you get wool that has what we say is a low beard. So you don't want to have lots of short fibers, because if you have lots of short fibers in your wool, you're going to end up with fluffy wool, which is lovely if you want a nice fluffy jumper. Not so great if you're trying to stitch with it, because you want to have nice sort of sharp lines and you want it to be quite specific. So, so he knows exactly what to look for from a sort of grading perspective, and also from a color perspective. So which brings up its own challenges, because because we are so insistent that we are British from sheep to needle, so we our wool doesn't leave the country until it's completely done, and then we may obviously sell to the States or wherever, but it's all using British manufacturing. And the British wool is beautiful, but you have to be really specific when you're buying it that you get as white a wool as you possibly can with as few coloured fibres in it. Because if you're dyeing wool and with 425 shades, some of our wool, some of our colours are very light and they're very subtle. It's really important that you get a very, very white base in order to be able to dye those colours accurately. And that's one of that's one of the things that we're constantly not battling with, but we have to be is in the forefront of our mind all the time to make sure that we get the right base, the right colour wool to start with, in order for the dye to be taken up properly.
Yeah, I love on the colours page on your website. Please be patient while this page loads. There's a lot of colors. I love that.
I know. It's a lot of colors.
And I have a very high speed internet connection, and it still took a few minutes. So
yeah, I know. It does take a while.
It was great. So when he buys wool, does he buy as much as he can of the proper grade, or
how does that work? So it very much depends on – so I'll give him projections of what I think our usage is going to be, and then depending on price and depending on whether he thinks it's great. So sometimes he'll phone me up and he'll say, Debbie, I think, you know, there's a really, really – some really good tops at the moment. I think it would be worth us getting, I don't know, 10,000 kilos or whatever. So he will also call me and say when he thinks there's a really, really great, a good wool at a good price. So it's a sort of two-way process, really. We work together on it. They know exactly what needs we have. So then
it's like any agricultural thing. You're really at the mercy, because I'm sure he might call up one time and say, hey, there isn't very much good here.
It becomes kind of
a guessing game at some point.
You don't want to buy wool that's too yellow, for example, because if you did wool that's too yellow, it's really hard for us to get our whites dyed. It's all about the color and the quality, which will be a totally different quality to that if you were buying for nice soft knitting wool, for example.
But then I need to produce wool thread, but this is not a good auction this time, so we got to get supply. Up and down all the time.
But we buy it in quite large quantity, or we commit to a contract in quite large quantities. So it hasn't ever really been an issue, because we'll go so far in advance, we'll know we've only got, say, 6 months wool left, and then we'll go ahead, because the whole thing can take the whole process can take quite some time, because it's got to go through a lot of different processes before it actually gets to us. We have to be super organized on it.
Okay, so when he makes a purchase, then he's saying to the farmers, we will buy X kilos.
Yeah, I guess to the wool board, which is the collective.
And then what happens after that?
Then it goes through all the various different processes, like sort of scouring and sorting, and by that point actually it's done, that part of it's done. So it would then be, I guess it would get it would go to our spinner. So we would send it to the spinner, and that was the one that I was saying to you about. It was in this really old mill, and it's one of the sort of last, I would say, fully working old-fashioned mills left up in Bradford. And it's beautiful. And when you walk in there, you kind of feel like you've almost stepped back 100 years when you're walking through the corridors, and you can, you know, and almost like the steps are sort of, if you're climbing the sort of stone steps, you know how sometimes if you go into old churches and things, you can see where it's been worn down over the years.
Right.
You go into these old mills and you think, gosh, I wonder who walked up and down these steps 100 years ago. And it would have been a real throng of activity back then, more so. But then you go into the rooms and they've got all the much more modern machinery. But still, some of it still looks pretty old. But our wool would then go there, and it would be it gets spun. And at that point, I say whether or not I want it, or the percentage that I want in crewel weight, and our crewel weight is a 2-ply, or a tapestry weight, which is a 4-ply. So they'll spin it and twist it to our specifications. And then from then it goes back to our wool merchant, and he holds on to it for us when it's been spun. And then from then I will then call off certain amounts, and it will get sent to our dyers, which is also up in Yorkshire, and they will then dye the quantity that I require in the colour that I need. So
Debbie, so you are actively involved in all of these steps outside of your headquarters building then.
Because the relationships, I mean, we've dealt with our, and it's also in advance of this, I phoned up our dyers, and I said, how long has Appledean's been dealing with you guys for? And he said, let me phone my dad. It went sort of back and forth. So eventually we figured out that we had records that went back to 1977 with the dyers, but mm-hmm. it could have been longer. So I am very much actively involved. I don't have to be up there all the time because they know exactly what we want. And there's a lot of trust, and we've been dealing with them a long time. So
right. Yeah, the history pays off there.
Yeah.
Okay, so then it just sits. It's all spun, and it just sits till you need it, or till the
till it gets dyed. And then mm-hmm. once it's dyed, so I will then send a weekly order up to our dyers, and I'll say, you know, I want this much in this color, and this much in this color, and then they'll dye it, and then it gets sent down to us, and we then hold it in stock down in Oxfordshire, and we hold it in stock in Hanks, and it's then that we then will either sell it as a hank, or we'll sell it as a skein, which is the ones, the paper wrapped ones that you were talking about.
Yeah.
And it's down in Oxfordshire that we have the machine that turns those hanks via another coning process, which we do here as well. And we turn it then into the skeins.
So a lot of your time is spent looking at inventory reports and knowing
yes.
what colors are running
yes.
short, and then
absolutely
okay.
And also having very complicated Excel spreadsheets that that can then project, look back over sort of since 2013 when we computerized everything, I can look back and figure out how much I'm likely to need so that I can order it in advance, so we don't hopefully ever run out.
Yeah. So talk about the impact of the pandemic and so many people still having trouble getting thread. How did you battle through that?
Well, that's very interesting.
I figured.
My turn. In fact, I worked all the way through on my own, mostly, with the machinist downstairs. We sort of stayed away from each other. But I came in every day for the whole of the pandemic. Hmm. And managed to get orders out from the very start to the very end, and then slowly the staff came back when they were allowed to. But I sort of basically treated my home and Appledean's as one thing, so I never didn't speak to anybody or see anybody in between. And
beeline back and forth.
As a result, yeah, we kept going all the way through. And of course, it was a phenomenal time for us,
right?
Because people were suddenly realizing how wonderful stitching was when you had all the time in the world and you were stuck at home and you were tearing your hair out because you were miserable. And stitching really came into its own. And really, we haven't looked back since. So that's that. But as you were said at the very beginning, it was a positive result from the pandemic.
Yeah, no, that's I think there's no question, and we'll see this for years to come, that needlework really benefited from a tragedy. Yeah.
Well, and people discovered that actually doing something with your hands and stitching is wonderful therapy. And the doctors were saying we should all be doing something mindful, and you know, I'm sure you had exactly the same in the States.
Sure.
And yeah, and so many people have come into stitching that were never knew or never wanted to do it or didn't think they wanted to do it before and now do. So it is a very, very positive result.
Yeah, no, it's and that whole the mental health thing and quality of life has just changed the work world dramatically. Yeah.
And so many people working from home now have more time, so they can be stitching at home too. So that's a lovely thing.
Yes.
And it, I mean, obviously, we had a huge spike in sales for that year during the pandemic. 2020 was a phenomenal year for us, and our turnover has gone down since then, but we are maintaining so many of those new customers that came in then. And not just general stitchers of the public, but also people who started designing kits and are using our wool in their kits, and had time to do that during the pandemic that they never thought they would. So we've gained a lot of customers that way.
Yeah, a lot of designers used up a whole bunch of those ideas they had in their heads, but no time to put on paper.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. Yep. Yeah. 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 So the fact that we were able to keep supplying wool was very beneficial. So, yeah, it's been very good for us, I have to say.
Well, that's huge because a lot of thread manufacturers really struggled to keep up with the demand.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think we were quite lucky, and that was where it played into having everything in the UK as well, because our supply chain was pretty tight. We were able to turn orders around quite quickly. So when, you know, in the moments where people were allowed back to work, our dyers sort of were able to really suddenly step it up for us, and they dyed a whole bunch of colours that had been waiting, and were able to get it out to us because I think everything was UK. And I think a lot of other people who were perhaps finding it more difficult because they were trying to deal with importing things, which was a lot more difficult, I think. So it was beneficial for us having a tight supply chain, having history with those suppliers as well, and having everything locally.
Yeah, we all helped each other out. I mean, it was really beneficial.
Yeah,
that's terrific. Yeah, I just did an article for the next issue about supply chains because it's still a gigantic problem in most of manufacturing, and it's all shipping and tracking and quality control, because so many manufacturers' quality control fell off because they were trying to hurry or they didn't have the right people.
Yeah.
And so having that tight in-country supply chain, huge advantage, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
In manufacturing, sustainability is a huge topic these days.
Huge.
Talk about how you, I mean, with dyes and I'm sure some bleaches and other things. Talk about how you guys are doing the sustainability aspect.
Okay, so from the point of view that we've got a pretty low, I mean, they talk about food miles. I'm going to talk about wool miles. So our wool miles are pretty low because it's all done within the UK. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, it's really sustainable. We don't, you know, we're not shipping our stuff all over the country before it gets to us. From the perspective of farming in the UK, farming sheep is really sustainable. So the three cloven, now I'm going to get this slightly wrong, but there's something about farming sheep and the way in which the sheep then are able to aerate the soil means that you've got a really, it's a very natural way of aerating and creating good soil. So from that perspective, it's pretty sustainable. Now, when you come to the dyeing, that's where obviously it's less straightforward because dyeing is pretty hungry from the perspective of energy. Right. If you're, you know, you can't dye wool unless you raise the temperature of the vats to a certain temperature. So you have to, it's pretty energy hungry. It uses a lot of, our dyes use a lot of gas. And so from that perspective, it's difficult, but there's not much you can do about it really from the dyeing perspective. You do have to dye the wool. Now, the dyes that we use, again, because it's really important that we maintain a consistency of colour. We can't, for example, our code 671 has always got to look like 671. You know, if somebody's stitching something and they run out of wool and they order more wool and it's a different dye lot, we have to make sure that the differences between those dye lots are really, really minimal. And so we use the dyes we use. I know that you've got a lot of dyes out there that use very natural dyes. We have to use an acid leveling dye. And wool, a lot of dyes for wool are acid because actually alkali will destroy wool. So in order for a dye to be taken up, it has to be in a sort of acidic dye. However, when, you know, what our wool dyer has signed up to is they're part of an environmental club, for want of a better word, called the IPPC. And what that means is any affluent that comes from the dyeing, they have to make sure that when they do it with Yorkshire water, they have to make sure that when it's when they get rid of it, it's at the right pH, it's at the right temperature, there's no sulfide, there's no chemical oxygen in it, and they have to adhere to all the right rules and regulations when getting rid of it, to make sure that it's safe. So that is as sustainable as it possibly can be at the moment. They also recycle a lot of their water so that they don't have to constantly trying to reduce their gas usage as well. So they try to recycle their hotter water. So they burn less gas. So the dyers try to be as sustainable as they can, and they are signed up, as I said, to the environmental IPPC. But that's the difficulty, is in the dyeing of it, I suppose. But it's as good as it can be. And then
I think that
everything else.
That probably speaks to just about any chemistry-based operation in the world. If you're sensitive to sustainability in the environment, there is a point where you simply have to use chemicals, and there's no getting around it.
There's nothing we can do about it. I mean, but there are chemicals that we now can't use. For example, so moth proofing, the actual what you would use normally for moth proofing, that's now been banned in the UK. You can't use that because of the danger to the aquatic environment. Mm-hmm. So we aren't able to moth proof our wool, and actually it's not been a problem. So we haven't had, I can't even remember when we've ever had anybody saying that they've had an issue with the wool being, not being moth proofed. So that's one of the things that we are very, aware of. So we do, we know that we can't use that chemical, for example, which I think is, permethrin, and that's something that's now been banned. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're as good as we possibly can be.
And dye lots, that's got to be just a constant monitoring situation there. Have your formulas for each dye lot and then sticking to that. But even within that, it's got to be really tough because you're dealing with the wool, which varies, I'm sure, from lot to lot. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's that again is quite a manual process, actually. So you would think that you can just, press a button and that will give you the correct recipe, I suppose. And in a way, yes, that's sort of the case. Of course, there's recipes. But every single time we dye, it requires a dyer, a real master dyer who knows what they're doing, to make sure that the wool's in for exactly the right amount of time, that it's because each, as you say, it's a natural fiber. So it differs each time. So, yes, there's a lot of manual input on dyeing. It's not just a matter of plugging in a recipe and walking away at all.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where we talk about automating manufacturing on so many fronts, but at some point for things like this, there's an art form and an experience that has to be in place or you just won't be successful. Yep. The sheep ate more clover this time. It's not taking up the dye.
Exactly.
Oh boy. Yeah. All right. So then, you get the thread dyed and, then it's stored, on Hanks, and then you put it into skeins?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's stored on Hanks with us, and then some of it we put into skeins and some of it we sell as Hanks. So a lot of the background colors people will want to order as Hanks. Some of our customers are carpet repairers, for example, and they will want their wool in Hanks. Some of our kit makers will want their wool in Hanks because they might put in sort of half a hank into a kit. So we sell quite a lot actually in Hanks. Mm-hmm. But then also, yes, we will turn it into the smaller skeins as well.
Yeah, and that was something I was curious about that didn't show up in any of my research is where your wool is used outside of needlework. So carpet repair and...
Yeah, so we've got carpet repair, we've got weaving. Sometimes it's used in punch wool, for example. So quite a lot of our new, we've got some new kit makers that use it in punch wool. What else? I'm trying to think. What else is it used in, Di?
Well, it's not just used in the home, of course, because it's used for a lot of public works all around the country and all around the world. That's a growing thing. That's another thing that grew in the pandemic, actually, that the people got together as communities and started to, like they used to, create something wonderful within a community where everybody joins in. But I think we've covered where our wool goes. A lot of it obviously goes to kit makers now.
But
we have a big carpet rug restorer in New York, for example, who takes huge amounts of wool, and it's used in restoration all across America.
Would have never thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because of that. We've got so many colors that really helps.
Yeah.
To match into your original carpet.
Yeah. Well, the shop near me here near in St. Louis, Sign of the Arrow, when I went in and bought a few skeins of Appleton's wool, and they have a unique aspect of their business. They sell a lot of needlepoint, or in your case, tapestry belts.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And,
a
lot of them. And she had a bunch of them hanging up there. I assume they had come back from the finisher to have the buckles and things put on. And she said just about all of them, at least the background, if not the entire belt, was stitched with Appleton wool. And she said that the reason it's done, and it's all two-ply, is she says it just lasts forever. And so
Were they from Good Threads? Do you know? Mm. Did you look at the manufacturer?
No, I didn't.
All right.
No.
No, because we have a company called Good Threads who we sell to, who are an NGO and use Haitian stitches. And they are making those beautiful belts for everybody across America, particularly, they tend to be found in golf clubs everywhere.
Oh, no, this shop sells painted canvas belts and then people stitch them. Yeah.
Right, that's different. Yeah,
she said this, it just never wears out, so that's what
people
use.
No, well, that's so true. It's a very sensible thing to use for a belt. Yeah. It lasts forever.
Yeah.
I'll let my wool buyer know that he's clearly choosing the right wool for us.
Right. Well, she had no hesitation whatsoever. She says it just never wears out. So yeah. 420 colors, and I'm sure growing.
425
now. Okay.
25. Yeah.
So that whole process. Now you inherited, I'm sure, a vast majority of those colors.
Yeah.
But then talk about what you're doing to bring new colors in, and where do you look for colors? Are we going brighter, or what's the approach?
Yeah, well, we've definitely gone brighter. But I think that was because I don't think there'd been a huge amount of new colors in probably the 10 years prior to Di buying the business. And so how did we choose? Well, we put in four ranges about a year ago. So we did bubblegum pink. It sounds like we're all a bit sweet addicts here. We did bubblegum pink. We did sort of fizzy sherbets. And then we did a couple of neons, like a bright neon and a cool neon range. And so those we went to our customers. And we said, what colors do you think we're missing? You know, we've got 400 at that point. I think we probably had about 420 because there were some colors that were so close to others that in order to bring on the new colors, we discontinued. But we said, you know, what is it we're missing? And that was, when we put it out on Instagram and we kind of were saying, look, guys, you know, if you could choose any color, what is it that you'd like to see in the Appleton's range? And so that's how we chose the colors that we did. We really went to our customers and said, what is it you want that we're not supplying you with? So yeah, that's what we did. And so we brought on four new ranges, and that was about 32 colours, and there were some colours, because obviously if we didn't discontinue any, we would just keep growing and growing and growing, and we'd eventually run out of warehouse space. So we went through and we looked at colours that really we'd barely sold for years, and also even though, but if we'd had a colour that we'd barely sold for years and there wasn't a colour that was very, very close to it, we still kept it in. But if there was a colour that was very, very, very close and we hadn't sold it, then we discontinued it. And but we don't like doing that, because you never know when somebody might come back and say, you know, I've got this needlepoint that's, you know, I found in my granny's house and it's 50 years old, and do you still do this color? And we always want to be able to say, yes, we do. So so it's something that we didn't really want to do, but equally you've got to move with the times, you've got to bring in new colors which have been hugely popular. So yeah, that's what we did.
Yeah, you can just about guarantee the minute you quit a color, some designer will use it.
Sure. Always, yeah.
It'll
like
be popular.
You didn't want it for 20 years.
Yep, guaranteed every time. Yeah, yeah. So this becomes then an ongoing thing to keep seeking out colors, and then I'm sure filling in color ranges is an issue.
So our color ranges are, there's a handful, like brights, for example, whereby they won't all necessarily be one color. So we might have, like, for example, our new cool neon range, there'll be a yellow in there, a green in there, a blue in there, a pink, etc. But most of our color ranges allows you to shade. So that's the real reason for it. So it will be a range of, so say we've got marine blue, and it'll be a range from dark to light. And it will mean that if you are doing shading, you can, in theory, shade perfectly from one color through to the end of that range. So that's how we do them. Yeah.
Yeah. And all the number of top end designers you list on your website is really impressive. Working closely, I assume, with some of those people just to get input.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. But that's exactly how we worked with the new colors, and also with, you know, when we went through that period when we had to discontinue some in order to bring on the new ones, we spoke to everyone and we said, you know, this is what we're thinking of doing. Is this going to cause you a problem? And so yeah, of course we speak to our designers all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and now, 2-ply and 4-ply. Mm-hmm. What are we seeing in the marketplace in terms of the demand for needlework, crewel versus tapestry or needlepoint here in the States? What is your experience now?
Well, it does vary tremendously to where you are in the world. We sell quite a lot to the Far East, to South Korea, to Japan, to China, and they are exclusively 2-ply. They wouldn't touch tapestry wool ever. I think America is probably a great mixture. On the whole, carpet, one of our suppliers in America is carpet restoration, and that's all 2-ply. And perhaps the first 7 years of working with Appleton's here, we were selling more 2-ply, but that has changed. That's changed quite considerably since the pandemic. Mm. And I think the reason for that is that you've got newer stitchers coming into the world who are starting out with tapestry, who want it to be faster, who haven't got the patience or the time, or who want to have a finished product much more quickly. And that's means that they want to use tapestry wool. They want to use slightly bigger gauge canvas and to get the job done and to, you know, have a finished project. But there's nothing wrong with that at all. Often those stitchers then move on and want to do something more detailed, which you can do with crewel wool and with finer canvas, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's where I
end. So it's a sort of way in, if you like. It's a way in. And I mean, we haven't discussed yet that we've now gone into the world of kits. So we sell a lot of tapestry kits which use tapestry wool and are done on 12 count canvas. And you can finish them quite quickly if you really get your head down and work at it.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of your business, because all of your thread is sold through distributors. I mean, I can't just buy it off your website, but then you have this.
Well, you can now.
Oh, can we?
You can now.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, we've just started our retail side.
Yeah, that just made it
so
dangerous.
Well, I mean, it's only 3 weeks old.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So now you can buy all our wool directly from us as well as from our distributors.
Okay. Yep. Now, see, I just looked at the colors. I didn't look at whether I could buy
them. Well, we've responded to all the requests from, you know, from our social media and from email requests that people just wanted it. So we've decided to enter that market.
Yeah. Yeah.
And especially on the back of selling the kits. The kits were obviously we were selling retail too. I don't know whether you looked at those when you were looking at the website.
Oh, yeah, of course I did.
Oh, good.
Yeah, how did that come about? What, just some ideas and, hey, we ought to put them together?
I think we always wanted to try it. And so we tried with a very small number. And we have seen what works and what doesn't. And it's just makes a more interesting company, I think, if we're also using our own designers. So the designers who buy wool from us, in all respects, I think you'll see, most notably Emily Peacock, who does the range of authors, the portraits which you saw, which you're now finding in America as well, I'm happy to say. Although that's not a particularly, to buy kits like that, is not a particularly American thing, we have discovered. And to buy a printed canvas with all the wool supplied as one item is not really how you do it in the States. On the whole, it's painted canvases that are then supplied separately.
Right, right.
Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. People go through the process of selecting threads.
Use wool that they've got or whatever.
Yeah.
But the idea of the kit, which has everything you need to make a specific tapestry, is very much how it's done in the UK. And it keeps the price down for the customer in the long run.
Yeah. Do you see that as a growth market or?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're certainly trying to crack the States and make them realize it's an easy way to do it.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I assume the States is certainly one of your largest markets, but.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
Needlework activity has just become so global that.
Exactly. Well, I still think we've got a long way to go.
Okay.
Yeah, we're working at it. Don't worry.
Yeah. So what lies on the horizon for you guys? More colors, more retail effort?
I'd say definitely. Yeah. So we've just started doing. Well, in fact, we did pre-pandemic. We used to go to some exhibitions in Germany, some trade exhibitions, and in fact, we've just done our first retail exhibition at the Stitch Festival in London. So that was really great to do, and I think we'd like to do, or we will be doing, more of those this year. And it's good because we actually get to see who uses our wool. You know, the end user, the real customer. And so that was good fun. And in fact, we shared a stand with Emily Peacock. So we worked with her on that. So we're going to be doing more. You'll see us at more festivals, more Stitch shows. We're definitely looking at increasing our kit range. So we had a brainstorming session yesterday, actually, on what might work and what sort of areas to look at. And so that was quite interesting. And then we were saying, you know, you've got to keep changing, keep moving forward. So Appleton's has got a phenomenal history, and we just want to make sure that we keep it moving forward. So, yes, we will be bringing in more colors. that though is, you know, it's easy to say let's put in a new range of grays, and but actually the time it takes to develop those is huge. But yes, that's what we'll be doing. And we always think, you sort of think, surely do we really need more colors? What can we possibly be missing with 425 colors? And then you think, actually no, yeah, we still are missing, you know, some. So yeah, we will certainly be doing that.
Yeah, that's got to be one of the most challenging things is more colors, but where and what. Yeah. And
we'd also like to, I meant to say as well, that to be in a position, and we're working on this as well, to offer our, at the moment we offer our wool in skeins and in hanks. And if we can offer it all on cone as well, that would be great, because mm-hmm. that then opens up weavers. So that's what we'd like to do too. So so lots in the offing for us.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah. Are you finding wool gaining in popularity?
Well, I think so. I think people are, on the whole, turning away from more non-natural threads. I think sustainability is huge, and wool is obviously incredibly sustainable. So I think people are coming back to products that are more natural, and sustainable. And you know, when you see, and I know with tapestry it's slightly different, but I think, you know, if you're looking at wool from a manufacturing of clothing perspective, I think certainly young people, I mean, I've got teenagers, and they're very aware of clothes mountains. They're very aware of the non-natural products out there and the damages that they cause our environment. So, I think wool has got a long way to go still.
Yeah, no, and I ask that because particularly in the last couple of years, it seems to me wool thread is popping up more and more as something that people are using. And so I was really looking for confirmation on what I was seeing, that there just is more use of that. And my wife and I were talking just the other day about the closed mountains. Yeah. And people going to thrift stores and keeping these clothes going, which is so fascinating, because when you look back in historic times where particularly women had dresses that they kept forever, and now we just throw them away, and there seems to be a movement back toward, let's have stuff that will last.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And in fact, I had a really good conversation with, I think, somebody who you work with. So Avlia Embroidery.
Yes. Krista West.
Mm-hmm. Krista. Yeah. So we had a really great chat, because she obviously does some absolutely beautiful designs, but hadn't done it in wool before. And we were talking, and she said, well, let me try and do my cross stitch in wool. And it was just beautiful, absolutely stunning. And now she offers many of her designs as an option to have it in wool too. So with crewel wool. So cross stitching with it.
Yeah, that woman, she's a design machine.
She's amazing. She's amazing.
Yeah, she's something. Yeah, we've done several shows with her. She is one of our favorites. And her sense of color, I can see the your colors and what she does. Perfect fit. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, ladies, thank you so much. Boy, this has been enlightening and fun. I really appreciate the time, and it's so good to see a company with that history rejuvenated and moving forward. It's really great.
Aww. Well, thank you. Thank you. It's so nice to hear somebody enthusiastic about stitching.
Oh, well, yeah, every day. Every day. All right. Thanks again. And thanks to everybody for listening.